is the Dazer Update for January 6th, 2019. I'm Filippo D'Onofrio.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Park.
I'm Chris Elogi.
And I'm Jan Red Victoria.
We're starting off a brand new year here at Smash Bad, and yeah, it's exactly the same as it was last year, basically, except for a few different differences here and there. Yeah, I'm changing things up a little bit in the formula, and you know, see if it flows a little bit better as time goes on. You know, we do like to try to improve the quality of the podcast. The operative word being try. So yeah.
Operative word being tried, actual word being fail.
Whatever. So you guys have a good holiday?
Oh yeah.
We're
solid.
Yeah, pretty solid.
It was mostly I slept through most of them, so
yeah.
That's pretty strong in and of itself.
Yeah, I was trying to have a good holiday, and then Soulja Boy decided to crank that all over the internet. And, yeah, that kind
Nintendo ain't going to do shit.
Yeah, so apparently, if this story ended pretty much exactly the way you'd expect that it would.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you go to soldiergame.com right now, you'll notice that it redirects to Nintendo.com.
Ouch.
Yeah. It's not like I want to like mock Soulja Boy for trying to do something like this, but
no, we got his whole rap career to do that.
It's just that, you know, I get what he's trying to do. It's the execution that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
Like for one thing, he still has that site where he sells a bunch of stuff, and it's basically that you know, drop ship stuff from China. There's no Soulja Boy branding or anything on it. Some of the stuff is actually kind of good. Like the Soulja phone is actually a pretty damn good phone, but don't buy it from him because it's twice the price. So yeah, that was Soulja Boy. I kind of wanted to put a bow on that one because it did happen over the holiday, and well, we kind of started talking about it before then. So
yeah,
it's free to wrap that one up.
It's a story that we will happily not be taking with us into 2019.
Yeah, hopefully this should be the last time we talk about Soulja Boy on the show.
Yes.
So
God, I do want to say fuck Soulja Boy.
Yeah,
because in his whole like backlash against people pointing out the issues with this thing, he kept calling people faggot nerds.
So there's that. And then he went and then he had the temerity of playing the race card. So it's like basically losing all credibility at that point.
Yeah.
So that was Soulja Boy. And before we get to what we were playing, we probably talk a little bit about the January PS Plus and Games with Gold games, because these are games that we could be playing. So let's see what we got here. For Games with Gold is actually kind of a weak month, I'd say.
The first game that they have available right now is Celeste.
Yeah.
Which I think we would highly recommend.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be on our list.
Oh, yeah.
For top games of the year. We'll talk a little bit more about it later on.
Yep.
That is available right now. The other game that's available right now is Lara Croft Guardian of Light.
Yeah.
Which I want to say people have said was already available on Games Gold.
Yeah, they're repeating games
years
now.
Ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a good look.
So you might already have that.
Yep.
Let's see. Starting on the 16th is World Rally Championship 6.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's the difference between 6. I think there's 5, 6, and 7 on this generation. So no idea what the difference is.
Although Teresa freaked me out because when she told me about that, she just said it was that Xbox Rally game, and I'm like, Rally Sport Challenge? And so I just perked right up, and there's, it's World Rally Champion. Oh.
Yeah.
God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm sure that's okay.
Yeah. Perfectly serviceable game.
Yeah. The other one coming on the 16th is Far Cry 2.
Which I believe has also been.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it has.
Okay.
So
if you want to see like what Far Cry was before it got good.
Or bad, depending on your point of view.
This is a game that's actually probably a little bit of a lead into like Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah.
In terms of games with systems that maybe are too much for what is good for that game.
Yeah. We didn't really need a disease system in a first-person shooter, let's just put it that way.
Especially when you set it in Africa.
Yeah. So.
But yeah.
Yeah, so
some neat games there if you don't already have them.
Yeah.
Celeste is like the highlight game you should play.
Yeah. And what about PlayStation Plus?
So for Plus, for the PS4, we have Steep, Ubisoft's Winter Sports game. Yeah. Let's see. We also have Portal Knights, which is a neat action RPG with some of the Minecraft like crafting and building stuff to it, which I liked when I played it last year. And let's see. Also for PS4, thanks to Crossbuy, is Fallen Legion: Flames of Rebellion.
Yeah.
Which I have not played, but I've heard people like. That is an RPG. RPG. It's just RPG. Not really. Mm-hmm. It's like side-scrolling kind of RPG.
Yeah.
I have not played it, so I don't know what makes it different from other ones. But also is Amplitude for the PS4 and PS3. That is Crossbuy. Yep, that's a really good rhythm game. Not quite as good as the original, but still really worth playing if you're into rhythm games.
Yeah.
Let's see. For the PS3 itself is Zone of the Enders HD Collection.
Yeah. That's yes.
And for the Vita itself is Super Mutant Alien Assault.
Yeah.
I have not played either.
Yeah. Don't forget that this is the, I think, second or third to last month we get any PS3 games in PS Plus, so.
They're stepping it up.
Yep. Well, this is it's an arcade platformer shooter inspired by Super Crate Box, which has a good game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think overall, probably PS Plus has a better lineup this month.
Yeah.
You know, if you're getting games with gold, yeah, Celeste is probably your best bet there.
Yeah. So it seems kind of weird that Game Pass has kind of surpassed it in terms of what they're offering. Certainly because you're paying every month. Hopefully at a discount.
Yeah.
Because I think they just added like Just Cause 3. They're really adding Life is Strange 2.
Yep.
Mid-season. Which sucks if you bought the whole season.
Yeah.
But also, now you got to wait for the rest of the episodes, like the people that bought the whole season.
Yep.
Not really getting too much of an advantage, but I think the first season is also on there.
Yeah.
Which that is worth playing if you haven't already.
Yeah. I'm starting to wonder if Games with Gold doesn't go away soon.
Maybe. Because they're not getting the greatest titles.
No.
They're not.
It seems like an afterthought at this point.
And it seems like if you want to play the better stuff, Game Pass is the thing to get.
Yeah.
And costs a lot less than gold does.
Yep. I think I re-upped this year for Microsoft 365. That's going to be interesting to figure to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I've re-upped my Game Pass sub for 6 months for $30.
Yeah, there were like, all kinds of sales over the holidays on that stuff, so you know, hopefully you got
it. Yeah, that was a weird, like, happened with their XO18 thing. Yeah. We're like, hey, it's half off for 6 months. We're not going to tell you when it ends.
Yep.
Sometime in December. And it's like, okay. Yeah. I managed to get some money right near the end and use some of the rewards credits I had.
Yeah.
To kind of tick off some of that cost.
That's our games that we could be playing. I guess we'll get to the games that we actually have been playing over the holidays. Shockingly, Tetris Effect is on my list there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's ever going away, honestly. Levels hit level 69. Yeah,
nice.
Giggity. so it should be. It's going to be a while before I get that 1,000,000 piece rotation trophy. So, I'm not going to build a robot to do that.
You're not going to grind it out either.
Does it stop at 100, or does it keep going from there?
I don't know. I don't think anybody's actually gotten that to find out. I think it. Like the rewards stop at 100, but I don't know if it might.
Yeah, I would be surprised if it just is like you have to get this X amount just repeats.
Yeah,
because if you want to keep going, have fun.
Yeah, Tetris Effect is a game that we really could benefit from some DLC. It's I wouldn't actually mind if they added like a custom like skin mode where you could make your own playlist, kind of like the relax modes, but you get the
parts
in it. There's room for expansion there, and I would be totally willing to throw more money at that.
Yes,
Mizuguchi, get on that. Yeah.
Yeah, they could also just disperse that through the weekend.
Yeah.
Event stuff.
Yeah. No, that's how they started with the Game Boy skin.
Yeah.
That just kind of showed up.
And then it became the permanent reward for hitting level 50.
Yeah, I think it was always the reward for level 50, but nobody had gotten there at that
time. They didn't know.
Yeah. So, so they've been doing that and a lot of emulation stuff, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. But suffice to say, I've been, you know, knee-deep in all that and figuring out what works, what doesn't, and just paring back my setup a little bit so that, for some platforms, standalone emulators just happen to be a lot better than the stuff that's in RetroArch. Just kind of been figuring out which.
Nice.
That's going to be a little bit, more challenging when we talk about my pick of the week. So, but beyond that, what else? What have you been up to, Pat?
Honestly, all I've played since New Year's is Stormblood.
Ooh.
I'm really looking forward to 4.5 on Tuesday. The Gimlet Dark looks like an amazing dungeon, and I'm really looking forward to going through that and really just leveling up a bunch of stuff that has been a long time coming. I'm finally getting Ninja up to level 50 and getting to the point where I can start using that in some more modern content. I finally started doing some gathering stuff with Miner, which I've also gotten to 50, and I'm really just waiting for 4.5 to drop so I can get into the new content and really just prepare for Shadowbringers at this point.
Yeah.
In addition, I'm also looking for a Tales game to stream because I've been planning this for a while. I've got a weird relationship with the Tales series because I hear people talking about how brilliant the battle system is and how great it is. And, I'm a battle system guy. Like I hold Grandia as one of the greatest examples of an RPG just because its battle system is so perfect. And if there's something to be found there in the Tales series, I want to know and I want to be able to properly appreciate it so that, I have this whole new stack of RPGs that I can play. I played Tales of Vesperia years ago when it first came out, and I didn't get it. Like, I would try to employ stick and move strategies on slower enemies and, get away from them, and then they would somehow melee me from across the stage, which just made me rage quit. And so, maybe I've just gotten off on the wrong foot with it, but I need to understand what's going on with the battle system so that I can appreciate it. And it, as far as I'm aware, has never been good at explaining itself. And so what I want to do is I want to take some time and just do some streams where I can have dialogue with, fans of the series to maybe help me understand it better. And so I've got it whittled down to the stuff that I have on PS3 and PS4, which is Tales of Zillia, Tales of Graces, Tales of Symphonia, Tales of Berseria, and Tales of Zestiria.
I do want to do Zestiria before you do Berseria.
Are they a series?
Berseria is a distant prequel to Zestiria, but it's in such a way that it'll make references to Zestiria that you won't get unless you play Zestiria first.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I'm glad I know that now. So,
I've never found the Tales battle systems to be all that deep. Granted, my first one was Symphonia back in the GameCube days, and when I played that, that was before I discovered Ys. So, to be at its most blunt, to put it most bluntly, like honestly, the Tales battle system has always been sort of a button masher until you get more of the advanced abilities. But even then, it's too customizable to a point where you can just go ahead and play lazy, and that would be my main complaint with the Tales battle systems.
So is it maybe not as brilliant as people are letting it on to be, or
I would say so, mainly because like most of the people who swear by the series don't really have that wide of a spectrum, in my opinion.
And Dan Reb is just plain wrong. So I thought about the system twice.
The Tales games are beyond childish. Like they're almost unplayable to me at this point.
Yeah.
Well, these are going to be some interesting streams.
Yeah, whereas I find them quite deep because they're so customizable, and also because of the fact that it can become pretty intense, you know, trying to block and dodge and all this stuff. It's fun.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if maybe the Tales battle system is one of those things where you get more out of it the more you put into it.
It is.
Yeah, so...
It's going to be. I definitely need to figure out how.
It's going to be an interesting journey of discovery for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's the perfect thing for me to be streaming as well.
Yeah.
In that spirit.
Yeah. Dang. Especially the off the cuff, commentary.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That actually just happened. Yeah. That totally did.
Yeah.
Also, make sure in those games, because one of the things about those games is they have like a dialogue, well, I say a dialogue system, not like a interactive dialogue system with like a talking wheel or anything.
It's talk from Phantasy Star 4.
Yeah. And it's happened, and you'll find some genuinely funny shit in those. So.
Oh, I've already done that in Vesperia, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, my problems with Vesperia had nothing to do with the dialogue. Yeah. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
All right.
So what about you, Brendan?
Well, pretty much my primary gaming has mostly been, first of all, Smash Brothers, because I finally got it for Christmas.
Hooray.
And, yeah, it's Smash Brothers. What can I say?
Yeah, it's Smash Brothers, and it's really good.
Yeah, I will say two things, though. First of all, is it just me, or is it getting, is it getting so overly involved on screen that it's actually difficult to be able to pay attention to where you are and what's going on?
It can be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's not something that's happened to me often, but there have been points when there's just so much happening on the screen at the same time that it pretty much just... It's almost way too much overstimulation, and I have to pause for a second.
Yeah. Well, that started with Smash 4, I think.
It's
like just been amplified a little bit more on Ultimate.
And the other thing is the adventure mode, which, for the record, I like the adventure mode. I like the way that it's designed. I like the way that they've sort of done it out so that it's kind of sort of open world, although not really. But is it just me, or does the map and sort of the way all of it is set up have kind of like a mobile game type of feel to it?
Yeah,
like something you'd see on an iPhone.
Yep. I mean, like a lot of the stuff with spirits is stuff that you see in a lot of gacha games, and I feel like Super Smash Brothers just does it without having you spend money, which is, you know, it's whatever. Yeah.
Because I remember like some of this stuff. Like, okay, the one that really hit it home for me was the part where you go down to the area that's the racetrack, mm-hmm. and you have to get into one of the F-Zero cars. And I'm sort of driving this thing around the track. I'm looking at this. I'm like, am I playing Candy Crush right now? Just
yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that go into the nuances with World of Light, but I don't know. Yeah. For the most part, for me, it was just over bloated.
Yeah, I will admit there is just a bunch of stuff. Like, do you realize like how much you have to do just to actually play like a regular Smash Mode game?
Yeah, it's totally.
Like, you have to go into like Smash. You have to go into like the games and section, and then you have to go to like the classic, and it's like, you know, why do I have to go through so many things just to get to play a regular game of Smash?
I mean, you can just go straight to Smash and just Smash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean. Like a single player version of Smash.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. The game is amazing. But it's also kind of overwhelming. But, other than that, I finally got me Rocksmith 2014 for my PS4.
Oh, nice.
So, Yes, and I got my guitar hooked up to it. And God, that I love having that thing because it basically just tunes your guitar for you.
Yeah, it shows you if you got a tune or not. That's
yeah. Well, and you know, it's got like a lessons mode, and it teaches you how to like, you know, it starts with the very basics, and you just go from there, and like it'll give you like a practice track and like several. Like even if you can't get it the first couple of times, it'll actually slow down so that you can, you know, get your speed together. It's really good. Right.
Yeah, I think I don't know why that game had been so overlooked. Probably because it came out at a time when, you know, like rhythm games and stuff were just kind of starting to fade.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ubisoft did something genuinely amazing with that.
Yeah. I absolutely say, if you are listening to this and you really are thinking of learning to play guitar or bass, get Rocksmith. Hmm. And you've got a PS4, get Rocksmith. It is absolutely worth it.
Yeah.
Fairly
certain that will not be coming out on the Switch.
No.
Be a little bit impractical.
That would be interesting, though.
Yeah. Hmm. But, yeah, that's pretty much what I was up to. So, Chris, what about you?
Yeah, so I have been playing a bunch of stuff from 2018. Things that I got on sale recently. The Switch has a big like New Year's sale going on. So I got Octopath Traveler since that's finally on sale. And I've been enjoying it so far. It has a nice style to it, though some of the environments... textures do not look great. The way they kind of stretch things out a little bit, it kind of makes it look like a PS2 generation game, in a sense. But the battle system's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I started with Obric,
good
which
place to start.
Yeah, I figured the warrior is probably the good place to start. And yeah, I got through the first dungeon with him. And getting ready to head out to his next part after that. And
his story arc is so good.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's definitely one issue I have is any JRPG with voice-acted lines should have auto-advance as an option. So that you kind of just listen to it and let it play out more naturally than just having to, you know, button through it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, you don't do that in cutscenes or anything like that.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to do that in JRPGs. And, but yeah, the game's pretty cool.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that auto-advance thing. I don't know if you had the same issue, but with Dragon Quest XI, I feel like that was at its worst. I feel like the text could not catch up with the voices and whatnot, but anyway.
I think with that... I can just sit there and button through with the D-pad. And I think that just works well for me for Dragon Quest. But also Dragon Quest is very much kind of tied to some of its roots as a retro game. It doesn't try to change things up too much with that stuff. But yeah. Also been playing a bunch of Into the Breach on the Switch, which went on sale during the holidays, not part of this New Year's sale. For $10, and that game is just really, really good. It is it's from the FTL devs, and you can definitely see some of those elements in there, especially with like the modularity of your equipment.
Yeah.
And yeah, I ended up doing a video series on my YouTube channel called "Returning to 2018" because if you read my top 10 list, I complained about not having that much time for games. Yeah. Or as much to play games as I would have liked. And I had like a big list of games I enjoyed, but just did not get enough time into them.
Yeah.
And Into the Breach was one of those. And that is a game that it's influenced by games like Fire Emblem and Advance Wars and XCOM and that sort of stuff. But I think it's really kind of like a chess with mechs. And that's, I mean, they even grid the board with letters and numbers, so you can sort of look at that stuff in that kind of light. And so you have three mechs on your side. You can sort of place them where you want in the starting area. And generally, each of the missions, you have goals. You can just survive for like the five turns that those missions generally last. But if you want to get added resources, whether they're the upgrade points for between islands or your there's like a resource point that you can use to upgrade your energy for your mechs, which lets you either upgrade stats or equip new abilities. And then there's the grid power, which is sort of your ultimate life, which that goes down if you let enemies destroy buildings with civilians in them. And sort of between islands, you can also bump that back up if you have enough of the resource points for that. But you generally do want to get to a good point where you have abilities, two abilities for each. And yeah, I'm still on my first run. I think I'm on the fourth island. I think after you beat two islands, you can just go straight to the end encounter, but it's probably not a good idea, like in FTL.
Yeah.
Where especially you want to start on easy just to get the hang of the systems and all that. Though I think in FTL, that final boss, even on easy, just going to kick your ass for a little bit the first few times. I assume the same is going to be here. But yeah, I'm kind of just building up my my mechs. I lost one of my pilots, though saving one of the time pods, I got a new one. Some of these missions have time pods that drop, which can have sort of the resource nodes that you can use to upgrade your mechs. And the one, at least after I had lost one of my mechs, or one of my pilots, had a new one in there. So I was able to slot her in and start upgrading her. Hmm. And yeah, it's a game that just looks really good. I've gotten close to defeat and then managed to just think my way through back into viability. And that's a game that people that enjoy strategy games should definitely check out. And also on the Switch, I got Starlink. It's currently on sale for $30. And I don't think that's a good deal for that, but they had the deluxe edition with all the DLC for $40 over the holidays.
Okay.
So that's all the DLC, which I don't know how much all of it costs, but that's a lot of extra stuff, extra ships. And like weapon attachments, basically like a lot of the. So you know that that's a Toys to Life game,
right?
And they sell a lot of that stuff in game as DLC, and that's I think a really smart way to do it, because that game's not going to live or die based on physical sales. Because
nope.
I assume they have not printed that many copies of it, because that's a lot of money to put on shelves, asking retailers to give a damn about your game in 2019 or 2018. And so they've been more aggressive with the digital sales of this stuff, which is smart, because that's where your game is going to really gain an audience. And so with the deluxe edition, I looked on the eShop and it's all the DLC is checked off there. So I got a bunch of extra pilots and some of these like ship modifiers and ships and such that I have in there as well. And so I no longer have to, I don't have to deal with the whole thing. If you saw the E3 like presentation where you have this thing attached to your controller.
Yeah.
It looks really bulky. And from what I've heard, like Jeff Gerstmann say, it makes it harder to control because you have this weird weight on your controller. That isn't like balanced in any way to make it fit well. But yeah, the game itself, I decided to start playing as Fox McCloud because that's the whole big thing. Yeah, it's like, if you're going to buy it, get it on the Switch, because you get this extra Star Fox stuff, and it fits in pretty well. Mm-hmm. It's like the intro happens where one of your people is getting attacked by these space bandits, and so they're about to send out the rest of your crew to go help them out, sort of save things. And then it also pans over, and it's like, oh, here's Star Fox that just happened upon this whole battle. And along the way during that intro fight, who is it? Slippy does the do a barrel roll thing. And I did not do a barrel roll, so I failed. eventually these like bandits win. They take the reactor to your ship, and so all the ships decide to, not they decide, but they just sort of lose power and just slowly crash into the planet. And everything else seems to survive besides the space station. And so from there on, you're kind of exploring this planet, taking on quests from some of the locals. It's kind of like an action RPG, but with like spaceships. And it's not really, it's not a space combat game. You're not controlling the ship like any other space combat game. When you move the stick, you know, around, you're moving your ship around, not like aiming it and then moving forward in that direction that you're aiming. Which makes more sense on the planet because you're kind of in a hover mode, a little bit. There's a little bit of like No Man's Sky in there that you can like scan the animal life that's on the planet. But it's a little bit weird in the way they do it. So when you go to start the scan, you're going to have to circle the enemy, the animal. And it's like, all right, this, we scanned it this first time. You need to find more of these to scan to like complete the DNA examination, whatever it is. And there's some plants that you can also examine, but they're not really done the same way. It just manages to do it on its own. But the combat is very much kind of lock-on combat. It's not done in any way like a space combat game. So that's sort of the big thing that you might not have expected out of that. But I've only played about like 30 minutes or so, but so far it's been pretty cool. The ship customization stuff is pretty neat. Like at any point, I can have like three loadouts with different pilots, ships, attachments, and all this stuff. And the different attachments can have some like shotgun style, like close range, some long range, some medium range stuff. I have a couple weapons attached to my ship right now that combo together pretty nicely. One does this like void thing that pulls in enemies, and I can shoot this flamethrower thing that then sets that whole area on fire. So it works pretty well, especially for the encounter I was going through earlier. And it seems pretty cool. It might be at least the first kind of like Star Fox game I've liked. Because I've not really been a big fan of those. Especially because I had played like the X-Wing games. And so coming into like Star Fox, like this is not what I want, sort of thing. I played a little bit of Star 64 on the 3DS, and it's like, it's okay. But this Starlink game seems pretty neat. The story is well done so far. I'm definitely looking forward to put more time into it. And you can do some real dumb stuff with the customization. So you can like stack. So the wings can be customized as well as the weapons on them. And you can sort of stack wings onto wings onto wings in a real weird and dumb way. I don't know that it has any actual gameplay benefit, but it's a real weird thing. And so you can sort of do that onto the R-Wing wings as well. I don't think you can stack R-Wing wings onto R-Wing wings and like do that. I think it's just sort of the regular stuff. But the way they have it all set up is pretty cool, and it works really well as a digital game. That's kind of the way that you really should be playing this if you're going to.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, that's an option, because...
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that the Toys to Life thing was the whole point of it. And it's like, well, okay, now I actually might want to get it.
Yeah. Yeah, it works really well for this, especially not having to have these little toy pieces to manage. It makes a little more sense when you have, like, Skylanders versus just each figure. But I think towards the end they had that stuff available digitally, especially I think on the Disney Infinity side. Let's see. Also, I finally finished Shadow of the Colossus, the PS4 version. I did that as like my pre-New Year's thing to get that done, which is kind of how I did it with the original game, is I managed to finish up the last few fights with that before New Year's as like a, you know, add this to the list of games I beat this year,
yeah,
sort of thing, which jumping back into that, I have not played it for a while, is a little bit jarring when you're going to that final fight, especially because I could not figure out how to get to it. So the way that final bit is, there's this kind of this bridge that gets you to that area, and in sort of a spoilers, the horse falls. It kind of helps you get to the point that kind of, I don't know about necessarily it sacrificed itself, it just happens to not be able to make it with you to get across. And so I could not figure out how to do this because like, I have not done this in like, well, almost like 12, 13 years. So I had to look up a guide and it's like, oh, you just stay on the horse and it automatically jumps over. And yeah, getting to the fight itself, the final boss like shoots this like thing at you, like a beam kind of thing. And if you're not behind a barrier, you will get, not destroyed, but you get knocked over, and the animation for that takes a while. Not enough that it's able to like do multiple of them to take you out real quickly. But you kind of have to just very much pay attention to your surroundings. It has a lot of little tunnels that you have to get through, almost kind of like a trench warfare kind of thing, just to get to the boss to start climbing up. And then I couldn't figure out how to... It does a lot of things here that the other Colossus don't really do, where you have to climb up onto it, and then it tries to grab you, then you jump onto its hands, and then that transfers you over to this other part of the body. Then you have to jump from there onto another spot, and sort of then eventually get up onto its head. It's like this multi-stage process versus everything else where you kind of just jump onto them and crawl up and figure that all out. But I eventually got it figured out and beat it, and that's there's a trophy for surviving for 1 minute in that final bit where you're trying to stay away from the void at the very end, and I did not come anywhere close to that. I could not figure out how to avoid it. However that was supposed to work, but yeah, that's a great game. People should check it out. I think it's on sale right now on PSN for like $12, $13. It's a game people should have been checking out if they've not played it before, or if you have, because it looks really good. Also played a game I got from the Steam sale called Human Powered Spacecraft. And I know Phil would know the game that is kind of similar to, I'm trying to think what it's called, Space Plan?
Yeah.
Where it's kind of a clicker game that is very much story focused.
Yeah.
And this, it's not kind of that way to the same degree, but you are on this ship. The AI has woken you up out of cryo sleep. Because you have gotten away from the rest of the human ships going to this new colony. And so he puts you to work on this like exercise bike to power up the ship. Yeah. And so you're clicking on it to build up energy, and you use that to upgrade different parts of the ship. And you work your way to ultimately upgrading the like engines, and that gives you like a boost that gets you to like the next stage of this whole thing. And it slowly layers on more things to upgrade until you ultimately upgrade everything. And that's where the end comes in.
Yeah.
But yeah, then you find out like the twist that the AI has not been doing this for your own good. It has like an ulterior motive. The AI has gone rogue, I guess. And then there's a neat little fight involving that. It's sort of thing that you don't really expect to come out of a clicker game, especially like a boss fight like that. But it's a pretty cool game. It is, I think, it was like 99 cents. And I had gotten it on sale for like 59 cents, so it's not that much of a you know, money drain on you, so it's definitely something people should check out, especially if you're into clickers. Especially ones you can beat in a few hours.
Yeah.
I think here's the... No, that's not the link. I hate Steam. Copy page URL. Maybe this one will work. There we go.
Yeah.
Human-powered spacecraft. It has a nice little pixel art style to it. And it's a pretty cool little game. And it was easy to tell this is not made by somebody that speaks English natively. Because some of the text is not correct. Mm. The translation. But other than that, it's pretty much fine. Mm. And yeah, that's been kind of it. Delving into a lot of stuff that's been on sale. Buying things, trading in stuff at GameStop. Because I picked up Mario and Rabbids Kingdom Battle, the deluxe edition, the DLC in it, because Ubisoft decides never to put that on sale. Yeah. So I was like, all right, I'm going to trade in this game. I got like $12, and the deluxe edition is $26 with the DLC. And that alone is $20. So I was like, all right, I enjoy this game enough, I want to get the DLC, and might as well upgrade to this deluxe edition.
Yeah,
it all worked out. So that's been pretty much everything. How about you, Dan Reb?
Oh yeah, I've pretty much been all over the place, similar to Chris. Before I signed on to Skype today, I actually just platinumed Persona 5 Dancing in Starlight. And I know Chris actually talked about it in the podcast a few weeks ago. There's no story to this game, and any slights to the story are pretty much just eradicated by the ending, which is kind of stupid. But yeah, the game is still a lot of fun. I obviously just said I platinumed it, so I spent that long with it. Took me about 13 hours or so. I really enjoyed the music with Persona 5, and the remixes were all pretty cool. There's some fan service-y stuff like you'd expect from a follow-up like this. But I did buy the deluxe edition, which included the Persona 3 and the Persona 4 dancing games. 4 I already played on Vita, and then 3. I was never really a big fan of the music, so I don't know if I'll put as much time as I put here. But still a fun little title. I wouldn't recommend it for the full price, but you know, if you saw it for like $20 or so, it's a good burn. I've also been playing Astrobot Rescue Mission.
Dusted off the PSVR?
No, I've been playing with the one at work, because my room just doesn't have the room for me to really enjoy a VR game. I bought this game for like $20 on Black Friday. Really good deal, because this game is tremendous. I would go as far as saying this is probably the VR killer app. So as soon as I popped it in, it just really felt like Super Mario 3D World, which I absolutely loved, with the only difference being it wasn't multiplayer. So the level design and a lot of the mechanics in the game were really Super Mario 3D World-esque. And so far, it's been a whole lot of fun. I've beaten the first two worlds, and I've been playing it completionist style, so I've been trying to find like every robot there is to find. And this is the only game I've played on PlayStation VR where after I take my headset off, I feel completely normal. Like, I don't feel like I've gotten sick or anything, and that's really just, I don't know if it's something to really commend them on as far as how far VR has come, but yeah, this Astrobot game is really, really good. Moving on, I've also been playing a whole lot of Tetris Effect. I play that on my work breaks, which I don't know if that qualifies as a break, because I end up being more tired after I finish. But yeah, it's great. I love all the effects you see. I just finished, I don't know whether it's the second or third world, but it ends with you pretty much being in an inferno, and the music and the intensity of the speed just really, like, really took me someplace else. And after I was done, like, I was literally like, oh man, I need some water right now, because it was just too hot. I also found this game on PSN for like a few dollars. It's called Blackwood Crossing. It's a first-person narrative game, much in the vein of games like Gone Home, stuff like that. So you play this girl who's on a train, constantly playing hide-and-seek and receiving some bickering from her little brother. And as you go across the train, you learn some various things about their lives and things like that. It was pretty cool. Another easy platinum. So yeah, like, usually after Game of the Year, I just try to spend some time on games that I can literally just waste time and chill with, and perhaps can easy platinum with. So that's pretty much it as far as like the real console games go. Of course, I've been playing a whole lot of Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. When it's holiday time, that's all pretty much anyone is doing. They're playing like the biggest hype of the year, and Super Smash Brothers definitely qualifies as that. I took like a few days trying to get through World of Light, and I actually did finish it. I didn't 100% it, but yeah, like Brandon said, there's a lot of different stuff going on with that game. But honestly, what really puts it over for me is the fact that just there's just so much for just really being a video game museum. And I think the biggest missed opportunity or the biggest change that I'm not a fan of is the whole spirits thing, because the spirits pretty much replaced the trophies. And if you remember in previous Smash games, when you go to the trophies section, there was a little tidbit on the history of where that trophy came from. And that's gone from Super Smash Bros. Yep. Ultimate. Yeah, I know that it's a whole lot of effort to write all that stuff down, but you know, I guess the JPEGs are nice too, but that's something I really miss aside from the board, the platforms and the targets modes that were in the single player. But I mean, if that's the only thing I'm complaining about, there really isn't much bad to say about this game. Oh yeah, the online sucks, but they'll fix that eventually, I hope. I've also started Celeste and got through a little bit of that, played some of the Messenger, and I haven't touched Dead Cells yet, or Shenmue, or Spyro, and I haven't really played that much Red Dead since launch. So yeah, there's a lot to play, and I look forward to this, 2 weeks of nothing coming out? So yeah.
Just about 2 weeks until then we have the deluge of all the crap coming out.
Yep.
Get into the meat of the program then. We'll start off with basically our top 10 games of 2018. It was a list that wasn't without controversy.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
Yeah. But it still turned out to be a good list, and we'll go through it and discuss the games that are on it. Do you want to take this over, Danrip, or shall I?
Yeah, sure. So at number 10, we have Dragon Ball FighterZ.
Really, it took Arc System Works to make a Dragon Ball game that actually feels like a Dragon Ball game.
Yeah. They did a great job with it.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, there have been some very good quality Dragon Ball fighting games before. Like Diamonds.
It's actually pretty damn good.
Huh?
Shin Budokai was actually pretty damn good.
Oh, yeah. Of course, that was a couple of jewels in an overwhelming sea of feces. Because there was a lot of bad Dragon Ball stuff, too.
Yeah, and then what can't be understated is the timing of this release. Because, Super was already at its height when this game came out. And, you know, Dragon Ball is, the gateway to, 90% of anime fans here in America. So,
yeah.
Either that or Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't think anybody's going to debate, you know, our Dragon Ball making our list. It's fantastic.
Mm.
Aside from the fact that they don't want it at tournaments, it's just a great game.
That seems to be resolving itself, hopefully, with Katsuhiro Harada being named Namco Bandai's esports head. That puts him pretty much as the as the overseer of the tournament scene for Tekken 7, Soul Calibur 6, and Dragon Ball FighterZ, and so hopefully he can step in there and maybe get Shueisha on the same page so that 2019 can be as big of a year for Dragon Ball FighterZ as 2018 was, and hopefully we can see this game become a mainstay for years to come, because it really deserves it.
Yeah, it is that damn good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and Tomoko Hiroki did that good of a job with it.
Yep. And before I go on with number 9, I do want to talk a little bit about the system we have in place as far as picking our top 10 games of the year. So as hopefully most of you have seen with the Smashpad website, all of our staff submits their own up to top 10 list. And with that, each game they nominate comes with a point value. So, for example, their number 10 game of the year would get 1 point, whereas their number 10 or their number one game of the year would get 10 points. And these all these points are tabulated so that they go into this final list, and this pretty much encompasses everything that we've chosen. So I believe there were over 40 games that were actually nominated. These 10 received most of the votes, and then tiebreakers were determined by how many people actually nominated the game, and then if that was still a tie, there was one more additional vote. So this kind of system is here to pretty much get rid of arguments, although you know they will still happen, especially when like there are some staffers, and I'm not throwing them under the bus at all. If you don't nominate a list of 10, the points have to be weighted in such a way where, you know, they still matter, but at the same time giving respect to the people that actually gave the full 10 that we expect. So yeah. And this is mathematical. Like that's the main thing I like about it. So yeah,
I think the thing we also should probably say is the top four on our list are as close as any top four games has ever been. Yeah, the bottom five on this list, the 6 or 10, were incredibly close. 5 points difference between them, 6 between the top four, and Smash was the only game that was just between them both.
Yeah.
So yeah, this was
easily the closest year that we've ever had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That said, like, I'm not gonna say it's the best year, but it was definitely the closest as far as like what exactly the top four were. But I think once we explain it, the top four were definitely deserving of, you know, being there. So yeah. Number nine, we have another game with Toriyama art. It's Dragon Quest XI, Echoes of the Loosened Age.
Yep. It's a great return to form for that series that had not been on consoles in like 13 years, something like that.
Yep.
And it's really nice to see that game sort of come back in an era where we see like the new Final Fantasy 15 is not very much like any of the other Final Fantasy games, even when they changed it with 7, 8, 9, going to 10 and 12. Like, it's very different than all of those. And so,
it was never supposed to be a mainline Final Fantasy to begin with, but...
Yeah, and that's sort of the weird trajectory of that whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be like a spinoff of 13 before 13 even knew what it was.
Yep.
And then got delayed forever and eventually got... fine-tuned into what it was and seemed to do pretty well for what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Then weirdly Square Enix came and just slit its throat right before they finished the second round of DLC.
Yeah. And then the director basically just told Square Enix to go screw themselves.
Yeah. So,
I'm still thinking it's because he wasn't going to do Final Fantasy Type 1 next, and that was kind of the deal breaker.
Yeah.
And so Dragon Quest XI comes in the first time it's back on non-Nintendo platforms back in the West as well, because 10 came out on the Wii, the Wii U, I think PC in Japan, but never made it out as an MMO from a publisher that where Final Fantasy 11 and 14 are really popular. So it's just really nice to have a series that not only pays homage to its classics and its classic style, but also is willing to do new things. Like, a lot of the towns in this game are unique in style to anything else that the series has done. Because I think most of the towns have been kind of just British, British, like classic towns,
mm-hmm.
Like middle-aged towns. And here there's like a Japanese town where they do all haikus. That's how they speak. There's like an Italian port town. There's a one from like the Middle East, like an Arabian Nights kind of town. It's like, it's really cool to see.
Just to hop on what Chris said, I think the most impressive thing about this game is its world building, and along with that, the towns that encompass it. Because as he said, every town here pretty much has their own culture and feel. Like, he already mentioned that we have that Japanese town, we have that Italian port town. I mean, you even go to the bottom of the ocean to go to this mermaid town, and they all speak in rhyme. Like, the writing with this particular point in the game was just super fantastic, and it didn't feel forced at all. So a lot of meticulous editing went into this, and it made it even more impressive.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little bit biased because before the game came out, I actually interviewed the directors of the game. And I even shook hands with Yuji Horii, and then they actually gave me my copy of it. And like, it was just awesome and fulfilling to find out that, you know, as much as RPGs have evolved, which they should have, that they're willing to just keep the series doing what it's known for, and at the same time just be familiar. I mean, like. There's a lot to say about, you know, me playing a Dragon Quest game, expecting a Dragon Quest game, and actually getting a Dragon Quest game.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's also kind of at odds with what Square Enix has also done with, like, Tokyo RPG Factory, mm-hmm. where they were supposed to be making, you know, these classic-style JRPGs, but with modern tools. And both I Am Setsuna and Lost Sphere came out, and they're okay, mm-hmm. but they're not really doing exactly what I think people were expecting when that studio was announced.
And then Asano said, hold my beer.
Yeah.
Yep.
And like, even made some changes, like you can ride a horse to get around more quickly, mm-hmm. and there's no more random battles because enemies just show up on the overworld screen. Mm-hmm. And the battle system's a little bit different, but it's not really all that different. They let you kind of run around in a weird way that's only visually different, yeah. because the way you do attacks and all that, it's all the same. It doesn't change, like, their ability to hit you or anything. It's just really weird. And it's like, okay, you guys kind of thought about trying to change something, then it's like, eh, we shouldn't. We still left it in. It's like, it's a game that does what it's trying to do really well. Yeah. And it may not be the most, like, showy, flashy game kind of out there, but it's really good for what it's trying to do.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where Dragon Quest XI got. I don't know what it would have gotten sales. I don't know if it reached expectations or not, but I'd imagine it'll get a much needed boost when the Switch version comes out this year. So
yeah.
All right. So at number 8 we have Tetris Effect.
Yes.
Yes.
And this one actually was a little surprising to see on the list, the top 10 overall, because I'm a huge advocate of it, but I wasn't sure, like, most people were going to nominate it. So
yeah, it's Tetris. We could probably easily say is one of the best games of all time.
Yep.
And it's really amazing that, you know, they let Tetsuya Mizuguchi come in, who wanted to make this game probably like 15 years ago when he was working on Lumines, ended up getting denied that opportunity and just said, oh, I'll make something similar. It made Lumines, which was one of the best PSP games. Yep. Now finally got a chance to make Tetris and made fucking cool Tetris.
Yeah.
Like the most stylish, best looking Tetris game that just has a really nice style and look to it that just accentuates the way it feels really well. And sort of subtly, even though it's not explicitly like, we're going to teach you how to do T-spins and how to manage your play field and all this sort of stuff, but it manages to do that with the effect mode in a way that just works really well. It makes you actually want to get good at Tetris instead of just be, you know, fuck around with it like you've probably done it for most of your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you guys picked up on one of the things that they did do as far as the mechanics go with T-spins. When you get one, there's a very nice, satisfying, audible click.
Yes,
of that piece slotting into place. It's small. It's a subtle thing, but yeah, it's like, yeah, okay, I just did something cool there.
Yep.
Finesse moves.
Yeah,
and it does a good job of calling out the different moves you do.
Yep,
like back to backs. Just getting your Tetris, even when you do well enough with the zone mode in the journey stuff.
Yeah.
Though oftentimes I fuck it up. It's like, oh, you just got a regular Tetris. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The zone so far, I think the best I've done is 12 so far. Yeah. It's like once you get past 8, then the screen like inverts to white on black.
Yeah,
that's a little bit hard on the eyes.
Yeah,
the problem is like, yeah, you can change the zone brilliance, but if you do that, it actually makes it harder to see.
Yep, it does.
And then there's occasions where elements of whatever skin you happen to be playing will fly in front of the field.
Oh God, yes. And it's like, yeah, okay, Dolphin, get out of the freaking way.
Yep.
Damn windmills.
Those butterflies.
Yeah. Yeah,
butterflies. And why is that flame in front of it? Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's better to just turn the play field to opaque, but that doesn't really alleviate all of that problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and that game has been doing surprisingly well with other sites' Game of the Year stuff. Yep. I think it won Giant Bomb's Game of the Year, yeah. Eurogamer, a couple others, which absolutely destroys people as far as like what they expect, because they're a lot of people going in, you know, oh, it's God of War, it's Red Dead Redemption 2, or it's Spider-Man, or whatever, and it's like these people playing Tetris, like, you know, just fucking destroys their fanboy minds. Yeah. It's like, no, this is a damn good Tetris game, and Tetris itself at its core is one of the best of all time. Yeah. So it's like completely...
I've always called it the justified. Politically correct selection for greatest game of all time.
Yeah.
Because even if you don't really believe that, then it's, you know, who's gonna say, no, fuck that game, no.
Yeah. Unless I see a lot of people like react to these things like, that's not on a game, that's not Game of the Year material. It's like, what the fuck does that mean?
Play it, motherfucker.
Yeah, like, that's just the Game of the Year thing. Like, the way people react to other people's lists is just ridiculous and stupid. It's like, these are their favorite games of the year.
Yeah.
It's not objective best Game of the Year list. Nobody can do that.
Yeah.
Like, even when people collect, like, the Metacritic scores or just figure out who has the most Game of the Year, it's like, that doesn't mean anything. It's just, this is all arbitrary bullshit.
Yep.
People just try and figure out a way to arbitrarily list these things that in ways that work for them. And yeah, so fuck those people.
All right.
Yeah.
Number 7, we have Celeste.
Yeah, this is one of the best indie games of the year. We could also throw a Tetris effect on that as well, because that is indie.
Technically, yeah. But yeah, Celeste is definitely an amazing... amazing platformer. And what has become probably the new golden age of platformers.
Yeah.
If you really think about it, like, the platformer has come back this in a really alone, big way.
Yeah. Huh? This year alone was insane as far as platformers go, especially in a 2D plot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, Celeste.
Like, what I like most about Celeste is that, yes, the game is punishing. Yes, the game is hard. But at that, I feel like it doesn't punish you. It actually encourages you to keep on going. Like, when you die, you're going to be on the same screen. You aren't going to start from the very beginning. And the game even actually, with its dialogue, it encourages you to keep going. And, like, you know, people with anxiety and stuff like that, like, it just really helps, like, that kind of regard.
And it also has some assist mode stuff where it can help you out with that if you need it. It definitely goes out of its way. Definitely comes from a line of platformers of recency from the, like, Super Meat Boy style of platformer that people call, like, massacre. And it definitely is punishing, especially when you finish off a section of levels and it's like, you died 58 times. Like, fuck. But it never makes fun of you. It never belittles you for being that bad at the game. It's just like, yeah, okay, we'll move on. And that kind of feeds into the story as well, where, you know, you're controlling Madeline here, who is kind of climbing Celeste Mountain and kind of, in effect, trying to get away from her problems and ends up having to actually deal with them in some really cool ways. And I really like the way it kind of layers on to the platforming stuff, at least from where I've been at, where you get those blocks that you have to kind of zoom through, which can lead to your death or help you get along if you fuck it up or not. Because sometimes you do that and, like, there's a wall on the other side of this and you just die instantly. It's like, oh, I gotta be better about this stuff. But yeah, it's a game that's really really made well, and especially when you think about what this team's last game was, which was Towerfall, which was a multiplayer couch co-op game sort of thing that's you would not expect, like, oh, they can make one of the best platformers around. Yeah. But they managed to do that, and I think, unfortunately, their next game, at least from some of the people, I think it was called Skydorn, they ended up canceled. But I think it's ultimately a good thing for them. They can start fresh and not be bogged down by this one project they were working on.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to see what this team does in the future. And yeah, if you need to try it out, it's on Games with Gold for this month.
Yep. Okay. Number six, we have Monster Hunter World.
Yeah.
A game that came out so long ago, I forgot it was 2018. Yeah, that was like summer 2017, just for how long that's been.
Yeah. You know, Monster Hunter...
Go ahead.
All right. Sorry, I swallowed a bubble. I was going to say, Monster Hunter is one of those franchises that was like super popular in Japan for like years and years and years, but for some reason it could never catch on over here in the U.S., and then finally, this game came along, and it became a big mainstream success.
Yeah.
So it's
amazing. Them, like, thinking about ways to modernize certain parts of it, especially the look, because they have very much honed in on that, what was originally like a PS2 art style.
Yep.
Made to the PSP, then the Wii U, and 3DS. And it's like, that did not really change too much in terms of art style. Getting a fresh look... as well as just making it easier to play, and especially even.
I think
just
it was too
up.
Cerebral for Western audiences before for a multiplayer co-op game.
Yeah,
and they were never good at onboarding. Like even looking at their demos, they just threw you in like you knew what you were doing, and if you tried to play that, it's like, oh, this game, I've heard a lot of things about it. I'm going to see if I, want to get this, and it can be really hard to try out, especially when it throws you into like a mid-tier mission.
Yeah,
and that's like. This is like one of the premier franchises I can think of that fucks up the demo every single time.
Yep.
Because it's not made for new people.
Yeah.
And it's made for people that already are sold on the game. It's like,
yeah. And know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for a long time, Monster Hunter has been one of the most unapproachable series for Westerners, mainly because of just how tough and grindy it is.
Yeah.
I remember actually when I first started Monster Hunter World, I'll go ahead and choose the guy with the big sword. It seems like he'll get the most done, like in any other RPG. But then you actually start playing and you find out, oh man, my sword isn't doing anything. And then you find out it's a total grind fest. So you have to hit him in the right spots. At the same time, you got to make sure you're staying alive and things like that. And what Monster Hunter World does, better than anyone before it, is the fact that everything is so streamlined and modernized in such a way where not really nothing, but everything you do is a lot less annoying than it's ever been. Before, when you enter each zone of a world, like there was a loading screen and stuff like that. The map wasn't anywhere near as intuitive as it was, but at the same time, the worlds were still big. So Monster Hunter World took these worlds, streamlined it more, and they even gave you things such as guide bugs to make it easier to traverse and things like that. And, that being said, I was never much of a multiplayer, online multiplayer guy. And then when I started playing with friends and started playing with other people in the community, I didn't feel like I didn't belong there. I feel like what I was doing, maybe I wasn't as good as everybody else, but what I was doing was definitely helping. I was definitely helping out on that hunt. I wasn't taking anybody's gear and stuff because they all have their own gear to collect. And all that stuff, just when you have a community that makes you feel like you belong, it just makes it even better. The thing that I got the most out of Monster Hunter World was this is actually one of the best communities in all of gaming. There are other communities that'll belittle you for the fact that you're a noob and stuff like that, but Monster Hunter is one of the few where there were multiple people who were out there willing to help me out, and it just made the whole experience even more enjoyable. And So yeah, that's Monster Hunter World. There's a big expansion coming out this year, so I'm actually considering hopping back into it. And they're doing a great job with the crossovers as well. So they actually feel meaningful to an extent. Like a lot of other franchises, especially in fighting games, just put people there for no reason. But here, it actually feels meaningful. So it's great.
Yeah, I've long since advocated for a moratorium on crossovers just because they've lost all meaning at this point. They're not special occasions anymore. They're just ubiquitous and, it almost feels like they're expected. And I don't know. Yeah. I think we need to get away from that and make them special occasions again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's kind of been Monster Hunter's thing, though, because they've had a lot of like Capcom crossover Nintendo crossover stuff over the years. Yeah. And they've done a good job with that here with like Horizon Zero Dawn stuff. I think they had Street Fighter stuff in it. I think they just announced like Assassin's Creed or have a special event for that. And yeah, it just adds to the cosmetic stuff in the game, which I think is perfect for this sort of game.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you brought up this is a Capcom franchise. I mean, Capcom is like the OG crossover.
Yeah.
So the fact that they do that in Monster Hunter is pretty much a given.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like how many franchises crossover into Street Fighter these days?
Yeah.
It's like Final Fight is part of that, and probably at least a few others, isn't there?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Final Fight was always part of Street Fighter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and go off a bit tangent here, but I actually learned a bit about that watching this anime on Netflix called High Score Girl. Any of you guys heard about that?
Yeah,
I heard about it.
I know about it.
Yeah, so for those of you that don't know about it, it's on Netflix. It's 12 episodes, and it follows this middle school guy who's a really good Street Fighter II player. He loses to some girl, and it's a rom-com kind of thing. And they actually go into the history of arcade gaming and gaming in the 90s pretty accurately, so I totally recommend it. But yeah, speaking of crossovers, we have Super Smash Bros. Ultimate at number 5.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we kind of already bled that one dry a little earlier.
Yeah, when we talked about it.
But yeah, it's definitely worth it. I mean, it's pretty much everything that you love about Smash Brothers increased tenfold. With, of course, the one drawback, of course, being the replacement of the trophy system with the spirit.
Yeah, that was not an upgrade. And they straight up admitted they did it simply because it was the only way they could fit more of them in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's pretty much everything you love about Smash Brothers.
Yeah, it's a brilliant platformer in its own right. It's a great celebration of all that is gaming, and that's kind of what Smash Brothers has become over the years. Yeah. And there are a few things I probably would have done differently with the single player mode, but all in all, I think this is definitely going to be remembered as a high point game in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thrilled with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do love now though that Smash Brothers has sort of become like gaming sort of go-to crossover where basically every developer and studio on Earth is begging Nintendo to have put one of their characters in the game. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not only the characters either. I mean, like, with every character, you get a stage, you get, like, almost 15 songs, except Final Fantasy. And, I've spent so much time just going around the music, you know, just playing some.
I think there's, like, a total of, like, over five, like, at least, like, 500 pieces of music in that game.
Well, what they do with the soundtrack as a whole is brilliant, because you have all of these songs from throughout the gaming industry, and then you have all of these composers from all of these corners of the industry just mixing and matching and making remixes. And as somebody who has friends who are composers, it's really awesome to see just to watch them doing each other's songs and such.
And in so many different styles too.
Yes.
I mean, there's, there's like a heavy metal version, there's a techno version, there's a hip hop version, just
orchestral,
pretty much any style you can think of.
Yeah,
and I mean, there's at least a half a dozen versions of the Mario theme that's like a rumba. You know, it's just
yeah. They even have some of the lyrical stuff in there too, like Escape from the City, and then the New Doc City song and Mario Odyssey, like yeah, and you know, and then already knowing this information. At the Game Awards, when they unveiled Joker, when I thought they'd have Persona 5 on Switch, I literally lost my shit realizing, wow, if they added Joker, that means they're adding Persona 5 music to this game. Like, the music in this game is already insane. You're adding Persona 5 into it? Holy shit. It's
crazy. Well, I mean, nobody can deny all that acid jazz.
Yeah.
Never see it coming.
Nope.
But yeah.
Fast prize.
I also want to say, like, I also wanted to say one more thing about the spirits. I know I spent most of the podcast shitting on it, but one thing I do like, especially in the world of light mode, is the developers really do their best when you're doing a spirit battle to actually really encompass that spirit within the game. Like, yes. For example, there's matches with like Deku Link, and you end up going against Diddy Kong with a green hat on, where all he does is shoot at you. Like, he's not Deku Link, but that's as damn close as you're going to get. And it's just funny seeing how they do it all.
Yeah. I've also noticed that.
And of course, Jury from Street Fighter was represented by Bayonetta.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who basically spammed the hell out of that sliding kick move she has.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, by the way, that's the other thing. When you go into the adventure mode, do not expect these characters to be fair, because they will cheat like crazy.
Yeah.
The game is actually the difficulty spike from 4 to this was pretty amazing. So, and then I do want to say one more thing about Smash's single player. We've primarily been talking about World of Light, but Classic mode also deserves its due here. Every single character has a different path in Classic mode, and all of it somehow makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have if you use any of the links, you end up going against the N64 version of Ganon at the end of the Classic mode. And for example, if you use Ryu, all of your matches are going to be in Stamina mode to try and make it feel like a real fighter. If you use Wolf, you end up going against other characters who were actually absent from previous versions of the game. Like, it's all just fantastic. All right. So at number 4, we have Octopath Traveler. This is the one that stirred some controversy, primarily because those of us that did nominate it, or most of us that did nominate it, had it at number 1. And it by far has the most 10-point entries on our list, but somehow only made it to number 4.
Yep.
So, yeah. I'm going to blame myself, because I put Red Dead over Tetris Effect, and if I put Tetris Effect over it, we'd have Octopath at least at number 3, but oh well.
Yeah.
No, I still feel vindicated. When it came out, I said it was Game of the Year until proven otherwise. And I still
otherwise.
Think if, I still think if more people had played it going into Game of the Year, I'm very confident it would have occupied the number 1 spot.
Yeah, maybe if Nintendo had a sale on it before New Year's.
Yeah, if I had a Switch, I probably it would have been on my list, because you can bet for damn sure I would have bought it and played it. But yeah, that's just a lack of platform on my part, basically. Kind of bummed, because it's a great game and I want to play it.
Yeah, Octopath Traveler is fantastic. We already had a full podcast talking about it. We even spoiled a bunch of shit on it. But I actually just finished the 8th story for me like a couple weeks ago, and my main gripe about the game was the fact that there isn't a whole lot of 8 character interaction that happens post game, which I don't want to go into detail about, because that's spoiler territory. But man,
step into taverns though.
Trust
me,
totally.
That's how you get your characters to talk amongst themselves.
Yeah. The main thing, though, is that this game is perfect in bite-sized chunks. Me and Lee will go into length about this, but the best part of the game is the fact that it's on the Switch. You can take it with you wherever you want. Most of my RPG play comes right before I head to bed, and everything about the pacing with this game is, for lack of a better word, perfect. Like, even when you go into a dungeon, it shouldn't take you more than 5 minutes to travel through it. The battles will take you most of the time, and at the same time, the maps for each dungeon don't feel overbearing. I mean, I can literally every other RPG will have their final dungeon map be totally insane. Octopath doesn't waste your time.
Octopath is never going to appear on anyone's worst dungeons list.
Nope.
Yeah.
And I've watched a lot of those.
And even though we don't have as much, character and interaction in the main part of the game, each of these 8 stories is absolutely fantastic. Like, only 2 of them seem cliche, whereas the rest are just, there's a lot of cool themes in here. So,
well, even the ones that seem cliche, they have some some tie-ins with other stories that make it interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. All right. Anybody else have anything to say about that? Yeah.
Pretty much.
Other than Phil, get a Switch, and
yes.
Lee, if you listen, play the game. I know you have it.
Play the damn game.
Yeah. That brings us to number 3, Red Dead 2.
Yeah. The game we kept swearing up and down we were going to have a whole episode dedicated to, but
it never materialized.
Well, I mean, it was a very eventful last quarter, yeah. So.
Yeah.
But,
And it's a story game that requires a lot of time commitment to it. You can't just jump in for 20 minutes and jump back out.
Not at all.
Yeah, that's the one thing I'll say about Red Dead 2 is that it's a game that does respect your time, but it also demands it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot going on in there. The storyline is definitely satisfying. The performances are top-notch. But it's a
game Oscar tier, I would say. Yeah, some of them
definitely Oscar tier. Yeah, but it is a game that it really wants you to focus on it.
Oh yeah, it's like, look, I am here. You were going to be with me for a while, and you were going to take me seriously.
Yeah,
that's Rockstar though. That's what you expect.
Yeah,
and there's this. It also helps that like the overall campaign story just sort of weirdly managed to tie into the realization of the kind of working conditions that were over that we suddenly realized were happening at Rockstar North. So,
yeah, that was kind of strange, wasn't it?
Yeah. But that whole game was just, okay. I hesitated to call it a game that was actually, that could somehow be significantly darker than the original Red Dead Redemption. Because the original Red Dead Redemption was pretty dark. It's just that it had a certain bit of what was then sort of the trademark Rockstar goofiness to go along with it at times. Yeah. So that would sort of offset it. And then, of course, there was the Undead Nightmare expansion, which...
yeah, which was just weird. But
which I hope we get something like that for Red Dead Redemption 2, because... but... yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. There were definitely some funny moments in Red Dead Redemption 2. You know, just the whole section of you going drinking
with Lenny.
Yeah, that by itself is...
yeah.
But, man, the game itself, like, the whole second... The game was already pretty gritty and depressing at first, but the whole second half of that game is just one massive downer. Yeah. God, it is so fun and enjoyable. Just even though it seems to be there, you know, it takes its sort of realism weight very seriously.
Yeah,
and it sort of
parts, yeah.
Yeah, and it demands, and it's very unapologetic about it too.
Yeah,
yeah. So, like in my opinion, the realism is what sort of contributes it to me not being all that fun. I've spent like less than 6 hours in the game. Like I've barely gotten out of the beginning snow part, and like the fact that I couldn't run throughout the entire time. Yeah, I know you can't run on snow, but the fact that I couldn't run, just, you know, it really deflated me. I was like, oh my god, how am I gonna get to the part where it gets good? And you know, like the story is fantastic, the characters are cool. Even though, you know, the shooting like gets a lot of shit, I actually have a lot of fun with that myself. Mm-hmm. You know, like
I actually really enjoyed the shooting mechanics in this game.
Yeah. I just haven't gotten up to the part where like I'm really enjoying myself yet. Like more so than any other game, it's like the developers are telling me, "This is Red Dead 2, bitch, sit down." So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've played a good bit of it. Yeah, my issues are kind of similar to Dan Reb's, where it feels like it's has too many systems in the service of being realistic. Mm-hmm. And they don't direct you as much as they probably should, especially in the early parts.
Yeah, I will admit part with the one like big major issue I had with the game was the fact that it didn't really explain its mechanics very well.
Yeah, and I have a new like drive to actually come back to the game after reading Patrick Klepek's sort of write up about how he was frustrated with some of the same things, just went back and just mainlined the story, just ignored all of the open world stuff, and it ends up kind of breaking the game a bit because you don't really need to do the camp stuff as much as it makes it out to be. Yeah. And ends up at a point where they're like struggling for money in the story, and he's like, oh, I got $20,000. I can buy a boat. Come on. He's like, all you got to do is ask. And it's,
well, that's what happened. Fuck the camp over.
Yeah. It's like, yeah,
like, Dutch, you know, I got like 20 grand in the bank, dude. We can go to Tahiti now.
Yeah, if you get a boat, just ask, dude.
Imagine how he'd react to that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of the thing that I really need to do, because early on, once you get to that second camp, they're like, hey, you need to go, you know, get some food, do some hunting, get some resources for us. We need all this to survive and bring in some money. Like, basically tells you to get to work. And if you just do that, you're kind of probably going to grind yourself into a burnout with the game. Instead, you should just focus on the story stuff and try out the other stuff if you want. But, you know, the story is the thing that's going to keep you going, most likely, over everything else in that game. And that's the thing that open world games really have to avoid, sort of putting a focus on the side stuff over the story, and especially giving you so much to do. Because, like, I played the Domino's game. It's like, I did it once. It took, like, 30 minutes. Like, god damn. Either I win or lose. Just fucking let's get this over with. Like, it's fun enough in its own right, but it's not the reason I come to that game.
Right.
I probably could have canceled out of it, but it's like, I've already spent, like, 10 minutes with this. I'm just going to finish it and never do it again. Yeah. Same with like the poker stuff and all that. And yeah, it definitely feels like a game that took them, you know, 6, 7, 8 years to make. Yeah. That they just added so much to it. I guess partly just to make use of all their team. Yeah. Versus what I think our next two games kind of pare it down in a good way that lets you focus on the story if you want and still have a good amount of side stuff that doesn't. They usually won't burn you out.
Yeah.
Get you someone who looks at you the way Bill looks at a pair of bolt cutters.
Yeah.
If you were to tell me 2 years ago, or even last year, that we were going to have God of War at number two at our list, I would have nothing
to do. Yeah.
And that's a God of War that reinvents Kratos as a character.
Literally as well as did. Yeah,
and as well as the mechanics itself, it's not just a straightforward.
It did actually. It literally did what I thought was impossible, which is take Kratos, who is the most stereotypical two-dimensional macho power fantasy in gaming, like more than any of the ones in the past, because unlike in those past games, you could actually have sex.
You also get a trophy for fucking.
Yeah, and they took him and they somehow managed to give him a heart and some depth.
Yeah.
And I did not think that was possible.
Yeah, it has to be one of the most striking and successful reinventions of a series ever in the history of this industry. Because not many get a second chance, much less get a second chance and the funding to do what God of War managed to do.
Yeah, because though you don't know, the last God of War game before this one kind of bombed.
Yeah, Ascension, that was not good.
Hmm. Yeah, that was still a really good game for its own right, because it changed up the combat a little bit.
Yeah.
Which happens when you put the combat designer on the previous game as the director of that game.
Yeah.
But was also kind of like, this is the sixth one of these games we've made.
Yep.
We're kind of running out of things to do and story moments to mine out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for those that haven't read it, Lee actually wrote a really good piece on his experience with, dealing with the shit he's been going through over the years and how God of War actually inadvertently helped him do that. Yeah, it's a fantastic read. Recommend you go Smash Pad.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
what a thing about God of War is that it really shows off how far Sony Santa Monica has come, and really Cory Barlog. I mean, you know, he's been writing the God of War games since they first came out, and this is like, what, 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. He's like his early 40s now, and it shows that, yeah, he's a dad now, and he just definitely resonated with what the story became.
Yeah, so, and he definitely went on kind of a journey after he left the series. I think it was after 2, because he went on to work on that Mad Max game, which was in development hell for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Then he ended up leaving, and that got moved over to Avalanche, the Just Cause devs, and eventually coming out in probably a bit of a different form than what it was originally going to be. And he kind of came back to Sony Santa Monica, was the director of the new game, and definitely took his own life experiences having a kid, and basically said, you know, him, his wife having a son led to Atreus being, you know, a boy versus being a girl. And it makes me kind of wonder what this game would have been like if he had had a daughter instead of a son, and sort of writing that would have been interesting to see. But yeah, the way the game plays, it's not too dissimilar to the original games, but it's very much a more modest style of game versus the original God of War games being all about epic scale. Very much over exaggerated moves,
a bombastic excess, basically. Yeah.
And this one kind of pulls it back a bit, definitely influenced by Dark Souls, but not using it in the same way. Like, there's no like stamina aspect to it, and kind of paying attention to some of the cool parts of that style of game and applying it to the God of War sort of flexibility a bit of it, because you can throw your axe around to get some longer distance damage done, but also you can just throw the axe away and start fighting with your fists, or pull out your shield and do attacks with that.
Is there feeling than calling your axe back and catching it and having your controller shake along with it?
Yeah.
Because that was just sensational.
Like throwing your axe behind an enemy or through an enemy and it goes behind them, and then pulling it back to you and it goes through enemies and does extra damage that way. And there's a bit of loot to the game that works out pretty well, especially ways that you can customize some of the ability stuff you have that when you use the shield. And I tend to use it as like a way to regain health, because they do not give you a ton of health pickups. Usually when you find them, you know some big fight's coming up. They want you to be at full power. And I really liked, because it's not an open world game in the traditional sense. It's very much a linear game, but there's a lot of spaces where it opens up, especially like the lake. And I really like the side quest they have around that lake. Like there's the one side quest area where you actually run into dragons. And that is a pretty cool whole area where there are puzzles that you go to explore, and they do a lot of cool ways of making the dragons part of that area, because they're like spewing like shit all over the place, so you got to watch out when they're aiming in your direction. And yeah, it's a game that has a lot of cool detail to it, and I really like the two blacksmiths that you have.
Yeah,
those are some of the best characters, because they just hate each other.
Yeah,
we've
been talking a whole lot about Kratos, but the supporting cast is just as good as he is. You mentioned those two blacksmiths who hate each other, and then Atreus himself, and then the head. It's just
Mimir. I just love the way the blacksmiths, like when you go back to the other one after having had work done with the previous one, it's like, oh, what did he do to this now? He just fucking ruined this thing. God, that guy's an asshole. And you're like, Kratos does not give a shit about this guy. He's like, fucking complain about yourself. Just do whatever you're going to do. I don't care. And that's just hilarious. Mimir, when he comes into play, is just really fun, especially because he can, you know, give you more lore about what's going on in this world. and all that. And he's just this head that hangs onto your butt most of the time. And Atreus, as much as like people bellyached about Atreus when the game was announced and all that, and it's like he came out into a character of his own. He's a kid that whose dad had not really embraced him as much as he would have liked, and let him into his world. And even ability wise, he grows as you give more abilities, make him more of a viable companion. Because early on, he's just kind of, he kind of shoots the arrows around. You can kind of direct him a little bit on that stuff. Mm-hmm. But once you give him more direction, that he can, you know, take down enemies on his own, or, you know, grab hold onto them and open them up for attack from you, all that sort of stuff. It's a combat system that works really well.
Yeah. I find it kind of interesting because when we're talking about this game, what they actually managed to do is take a concept that has been kind of reviled in the industry for a little while, the concept of the escort mission, and actually build an entire game around it and make it work.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're not really escort. What, you're escorting your wife's ashes, the mother's ashes. Yeah. That's the escort, and you two are kind of on this journey together.
Yeah.
And it oftentimes does not go that well, but when it does, you know, it brings us along some really cool moments.
Yeah. Yeah. I just like how, you know, how intimate and, well, yeah, it's just, it's a very personal game. It oozes personality.
Yeah.
And that's not something I would have ever expected from a God of War game.
Yeah. Yeah, and it does, it does the thing that people have been talking about for a long time that the series should do, which is go into other mythos.
Yeah.
Especially, I think David Jaffe said, like, initially that was kind of the plan, where each game, like, there would be these mythos that would just have taken hold of parts of the world, and Kratos would be able to go between them in successive games. Yeah. And they found a good way to do that. And I would especially say, if you have played this, you should definitely play God of War 3 Remastered. On the PS4, it's on sale for, I think, $3 right now, till about the 15th. And if you want to see what Kratos was doing before he came to the Norse lands, I had a friend who had not had a PlayStation in a while, and he picked up that game. And I was, like, talking to him as he was playing through. I was like, yeah, this is really fucking good. And once he beat it, I was like, so how long did you take to before you figured out you didn't have to keep beating that guy? And he's like, oh, yeah, it was like a minute or two. I was like, what the hell's going on? And I was like, yeah, that's just a commentary on your own issues. Then he kind of slinks away at the end, disappears, and kind of goes into hiding. And you find out, okay. So he kind of regathered himself, came to the Norse worlds, kind of built a new life for himself.
Yeah.
And kind of the weird thing about the whole game is it's kind of him just wanting to be left alone. And nobody else wanting to let him be alone.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't have to do any of this shit in this game.
No.
Just let him go to the mountain and put the ashes to rest. It could have all been avoided. Which, kind of what happened in the original series.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, we're near 2 hours, and we can talk about God of War for as long as we need to. But yeah, moving on to number one. Again, it's crazy. Like, if you were to tell me that our top three would have a Rockstar game, a God of War game, and a Marvel game by the name of Marvel Spider-Man at number one, I'd call you crazy, but here we are.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and this game is just really fantastic. It's one of the best open world games we've seen this generation. And it's a game that's...
And it's made me reflect on just how many shitty superhero games there have been in the past.
Shitty Spider-Man games.
Yeah, and only now people have finally gotten to the point where they can actually make something that's worthy of the brand.
Yeah, it was the Batman Arkham Asylum was like, hey, maybe if we don't base these all on movies, that has to be limited to the time and scale that those offer, and put a decent dev on it, it's like, you can get some great stuff out of it. And this kind of proves, hey, what if we put one of the best developers in the industry on a comic property that they're excited about? You get this damn good of a game. And it's like, okay, Marvel, start getting good developers involved and good publishers. Be curious to see how that Avengers game turns out, because we've heard nothing.
Yeah, since it was announced, basically.
Yeah, and that announcement ended up leading to Shadow of the Tomb Raider, because that got pushed onto a different developer because Crystal was busy with the Avengers game. Hmm. So, and that ended up not going well at all.
Nope.
But yeah, this game, like I said earlier, like, it's an overall game that respects your time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't force you into side quests if you don't want to. And it lets the story kind of dictate how things are going on in this world. Because you oftentimes come out of a mission and it's like, oh, I got some time to kill. And you can go do some side quest stuff if you want. And it'll be like, it'll pop back in, like some phone call comes in to lead you into the next story mission. And they do a really good job with that stuff. Especially if you happen to get a call and then go into like one of the battle arenas or something like that. It's like, oh, hold on. You know, it calls back afterwards. They do a really good job with that, like, interruption stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool game that makes you feel like Spider-Man a lot. It does it really well with the web slinging and the attacks, the variety of attacks and the athleticism he has. To dodge attacks, to throw, you know, missiles back at enemies or pull their guns off out of their hands and throw them back. The ability to just throw enemies around, to manipulate the AI and all this stuff that works really well in a way that kind of goes beyond the Arkham Asylum thing where people just say, oh, it's Arkham Asylum. It's, you know, rip off of that. It's like, it's similar. But Spider-Man as a character is so much more flexible and improvisational than Batman is, especially in those games where he's kind of robotic in a sense. He's not able to really break out of combat in the way that Spider-Man can here. Mm. And also the writing is really damn good.
Oh my God.
Like, you don't have to know anything about Spider-Man coming into this game other than he gets bit by a radioactive spider and gets these powers. And they lead you through just as well as if you are a veteran of the character.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way that, because they don't sit here and like expect you to be a veteran, like knows all these characters and all this. So it's a really cool story that can appeal to anybody. And it makes you give a damn about even the villains. Because you understand why they are doing what they're doing. And you're like, oh, yeah, I completely understand why, you know, Dr. Octavius is doing these things. You know, I understand why Norman Osborn is doing these things, especially the stuff that happens at the end. But yeah, it's a game that just does what it's doing really well in a way that we've never really seen out of these licensed games.
Yeah. Spider-Man was number two on my list, but it was by far the most fun I had with a video game this year. When I got the game, I literally got all the backpacks in that same sitting and didn't finish playing I didn't turn it off until like 4 a.m. And I got it and got home at like 10 p.m. So, and I still had work in the next few hours. And yeah, like there's just so much to do. And at the same time, it doesn't really force anything onto you. You like, you do what you want to do. And Spider-Man's the first time where I played an open world game and didn't feel the desire or need to steal a car, because first of all, you can't, and second of all, the traversal is just so good.
Yeah, I didn't get the trophy for fast travel until the very end.
Yeah,
I didn't want to. Mm-hmm. Even though that's actually a really cool part of the game, because Spider-Man just goes into the subway, and there's lots of little scenes there of him just sitting there while looking at the paper, the person who's reading next to him with him on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or where I was, I had the underwear Spider-Man suit. And so him going on the subway in his underwear added a bit to that whole bit. I was like, yep, New York, just Spider-Man in his underwear hanging out in the subway.
That's nobody giving a fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, with open world games, like, you always want to waste time and, you know, kill other people. And, like, in Spider-Man, if you try to, like, attack civilians, he'll just give them high fives, point at them and say, hey, yep, I'm Spider-Man, and laugh. Yeah, it's just really entirely positive. And that's what I love about it. It's just not a whole lot of negativity that you see in a lot of games these days. This game is just fun the whole way through.
I also Spider-Man's to always mention, a naively positive character.
Yeah. I also wanted to mention like one fun fact, particularly about the sound design. Like, well, first of all, the voice actors in this game did a fantastic job. Yuri was awesome as Spider-Man. And one of the most impressive parts about it, especially when you're slinging, is that Yuri will actually sound different as you're swinging. Like, you know, he'll have a different forms of breathing as he's talking while he's swinging versus while he's walking around. And, like, you know, it's these little details that make it feel all the more impressive. And, you know, like, in my opinion, this was before I saw Into the Spider-Verse, this is the best Spider-Man story in every medium that I've you know, dealt with him with.
Wow.
Yeah. It just felt fantastic. Like, the only part I didn't like was, like, the way they incorporated some of the villains who I won't name. But at the same time, it did come out of left field. Like, I felt surprised. Like, Spider-Man's one of my favorite superheroes. And the fact that, you know, they caught me off guard a few times just made it all the more impressive to me.
Yeah, and I especially like the photo mode. The way all the options they have. Like, that's what I used as my image on my top 10 list. It's, like, just a random picture of Peter Parker just standing in the lab, and it's like amazing sticker in there. And it's like a bunch of these really stupid frames you can use. There's a lot of the comic style frames, and you can go into like a selfie mode, which people used once they got to the cemetery and found Uncle Ben's plot.
Yeah.
Of having him just doing this like Spider-Man thing over his grave. And it's like, okay, this is just real weird.
Visiting his grave, actually, gets you a trophy.
Yeah. There's, I think also Alexander Hamilton's grave is over there, too.
Yep.
You can find them if you're a Hamilton fan.
Mm-hmm. I recognize it. It's the one with the pyramid on it.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and...
Yeah, their version of Manhattan is pretty damn accurate.
Yeah. And I really liked how they had the Avengers Tower in there. And if there is like one knock, I would say is like maybe the crime stuff, there's a little bit too much of that. I think they could have done with just requiring you to do three of each instead of five, because especially when you get to the later parts of the game where they add two new factions, yeah, it's like, okay, there's another set of these to do, but
at the same time, you don't have to do it. So
yeah. I ended up just grinding them all out pretty early on, and then I played the story and it's like, oh, here's like the break they give you, so you could have gone and done this stuff. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah. But it didn't really affect it for me. But yeah, that's a game that pays a lot of homage to the many, many different stories they've told in Spider-Man, especially like the backpack stuff. You went and looked in all those items. He's like, oh yeah, this is from the first time I fought Rhino, because this is Spider-Man 8 years after he got bit and became Spider-Man. So you get this whole history out of these items and the way they introduce that stuff.
And there's, you know, all of the suits that are in the game. There's the entire series of J. Jonah Jameson podcasts.
Yeah.
Hilarious. it's an amazingly well done game. I do have to call
it. There's something about the idea that's, I don't know why, but for some reason that being what he ends up doing just makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Like I said, I do have to call them out on the DLC because I think that didn't quite turn out very well.
Yeah, I think everybody would have been fine if they had not, because it seemed like stuff they cut out, you know, in the final stages of development. It's like, we can't get these done.
Yeah,
we'll finish them and put them out as like season pass stuff. I kind of wish they would have delayed, like had them come out like throughout this year as like bigger packs. Bigger story stuff. I'm
just not bothered because it didn't really need them.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need that DLC anyway. No. They hint at it a little bit with the Black Knight, the Black Cat story side mission stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like it for really where they hint into it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a game that I really do hope Insomniac gets a chance to make a sequel, because the way they set things up for a sequel is really, really interesting for what they can do with that stuff.
Yeah. They'll for sure be doing a sequel. This will definitely be a series, but I don't want them just doing that. I want them doing all of Marvel. But
Yeah,
just give the Marvel universe to Insomniac there.
Yeah.
Also, a best Stan Lee cameo in a video game ever. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of that, I
I keep going back to something that Stan Lee said about Spider-Man, and that was that if there was any reader avatar character in Marvel, it would be Spider-Man, and that it could be basically anyone under that mask, which makes me wonder if any sequel might manifest itself in a Spider-Verse game where you're more or less creating your own Spider-Man and doing whatever you would do in that role. More so than being cast in the role of Peter Parker or any of the other existing characters. That would be compelling to me.
Yeah.
I think that's probably in the works.
Yeah, I could definitely see there being like a Spider-Verse spin-off game.
Mm. Yeah.
Which they're already doing that as well as movie stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. Because they're doing the sequel and a spin-off with just some of the lady spider people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, before we like wrap this up, I kind of want to like look at the top three games that we have here, and I'm noticing something that's I don't know if anybody picked up on. Number three, Red Dead 2, is a very gritty, very realistic, very depressing, basically open world game.
Kind of.
It does what it does exceptionally well. Number two, God of War, is a somewhat less open, because it's not really open world. It's open-ish. But it's a very intimate, very personal, very very crafted experience, is what I want to say. And then number one, Spider-Man, is just plain positive. Positive wins.
Even when there's some of the side stuff, the research stations, like the city is on the verge of destruction so many times that you just happen to go to the research station at the right time to stop the city from exploding or getting a deadly virus or whatever exposed to it over the next few minutes. It's like, oh, we just avoided this catastrophe about 20 times.
Yep. Any final thoughts before we move on?
Nope.
Not really.
Not really. It was just a great year for games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what we've seen for what's probably going to come next year might surpass it, but
yeah. It might.
We'll have to see.
I kind of wish I had played Octopath Traveler, but I'll see if I can get on that this year.
It's on sale right now. You can get it, and then you got to buy a Switch within the next few days, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I could technically buy it online and then have it in my Nintendo account.
You have to have a hardware attached to the account first.
Really?
Yep, that's the Nintendo thing.
Oh, Nintendo.
Fuck you, Nintendo.
That's been the case since, I think, the Wii U and the 3DS.
Mm-hmm.
God damn, was it, we keep saying Nintendo gonna Nintendo?
Yeah.
All right, so let's... we're running a bit long, so we'll see how much of this we can get through. So let's look back on 2018. There was a lot we did like, a lot we didn't like, so we'll just jump in and talk about it. I guess we kind of, what we liked, we kind of already covered in the list that we just did, so we won't really have to go too far in there.
Okay, I'll tell you something that I did like about this year. A lot of the major publishers and developers got taken down a peg. EA especially. EA botched Star Wars Battlefront 2 so badly that it became national headlines.
Hmm.
That's an achievement in and of itself.
Yeah. And then I think this was also the year that a lot of people realized that Blizzard was owned by Activision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, the year that developers became more outspoken about the kind of working conditions they have to endure. And there's now serious talk of unionization, which is
good.
Something I've been screaming about for years, and now they're finally taking it seriously. I think this was partly... I actually do think this was partly inspired by what was going to be the Voice Actors Guild basically going on strike. And it made a lot of people basically realize that... that, yeah, it made people more aware of the type of stuff developers have to deal with. That's what I like. Oh, and other thing I also liked is that we basically had a bunch of genres that people thought were dead have actually become back, come back and become a big deal again.
Forefront.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, yeah, yep. Red Dead, which is a Western, and people may not believe it, but Westerns were kind of dead for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think they've ever really been alive and thriving in the gaming scope. They just, every now and again, you'll get one, and, mm-hmm. you know, your mileage may vary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then Octopath basically brought back the old school JRPG back to the forefront as well.
Yeah, that and Dragon Quest.
Yeah, that and Dragon Quest. Spider-Man basically showed that there is a good Spider-Man game in him.
Yeah,
you get the right people doing it.
Yeah, you find the right team, you can bring back any comic property.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I just let Activision throw all their crap at people.
Yeah. And then finally, Tetris showed that it's still got a ton of mileage in it. Especially for a property that is, what, like 30-plus years old now?
Yeah.
But, I think the original one in Russia was like 1982.
Yeah, on one of their old-ass computers and one of their Yeah, I mean, that was back... The Soviet Union was still alive when that game
came out.
It was in its last decade of existence, but...
Barely in its...
And that was... Yeah. Basically, I mean, that's how old that franchise is.
Yep.
Yeah. So I guess we'll go to what we didn't like. And, this one is, I guess I wouldn't say it's something I don't like in the industry because it's something I don't like in general. And that's this entire attack culture that we've gone into.
Yeah.
It seems like you can't disagree with somebody anymore. It's like, now it's like if they have a different opinion than yours, they are the enemy.
Yeah, it's an affront to yourself and others, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially if it's the developer or publisher of a thing you want to like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, as it was in case in both ends of the Spider-Man thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this even comes down to, like, something as stupid as, like, okay, so actually, this game was last year, but it's a good example. When the recent, and now it's completely, why can't I think of it? Oh my God, I reviewed this game. I loved it. I loved killing Nazis. Why can I not think of the name?
Wolfenstein?
Thank you.
Yeah.
When Wolfenstein came out and they made the whole point, it's like, you know, you're going to be shooting Nazis in the game. People got angry about the fact that you're shooting Nazis.
Yeah. That was this year, too, by the way.
Yeah, that was also this year. Didn't it also come? Yeah, because it came out for the Switch, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people still got...
Kill Nazis on the go.
Hell but yeah.
It got into stuff like Battlefield 5, which had its own issues outside of the other shit that people were complaining about.
Battlefield 5 was... Well, that wasn't, like, so much a, like, problem that they were telling a fictional story.
Uh-huh.
That was more of the fact that they were actually changing events.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
I mean, they did the exact same thing with Battlefield 1 with World War 1, because, like, I can tell you for a fact, most of the people in the Italian Arditi did not walk around in armor carrying machine guns.
Yeah.
But I get...
It's just that there were they did a lot to change events to tell a specific story when there were plenty of examples of that kind of heroism that they could have drawn.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's the biggest complaint.
Let's see what else. There was I'm trying to think of like a really big one. There was that. There was what was the other?
No, there was the whole Diablo Immortal thing.
Yeah, that was more of a
that was well deserved.
Yeah, that was really a case of really bad timing, and also really bad lead up as well. Because you don't take a property like Diablo and lead people with that, and then reveal it's a mobile game.
No,
yeah,
Diablo is like hardcore shit. You don't screw with that property.
No.
And then, you know, it's just, it's really just another thing of, unfortunately, even though Gamergate is basically dead, the dregs of it still live on.
And now there's Comicsgate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which are attacking Gamergate victims now.
It's made me realize that the whole nerd demographic really is... Ugh. I hate it.
Yeah, I mean...
I said it more than once. Yeah, I made it... I said it more than once this year. I basically said, even though I love games, I want to kill gamers and everything associated with them.
Yeah. And they constantly give you reasons to feel that way, which is... Yeah. Which is part of the reason that we tend not to cover the drama stories on the...
Yeah, we try to do the actual meat and potato stuff. It's just that every so often the stuff goes so out of proportion, we have to talk about it.
Toxicity in general is just, like, stupid. Phil went into detail about, you know, Spider-Man overall being a very positive experience. But one thing that wasn't positive was a lot of the idiot gamers that kept on trying to get Insomniac to put so-and-so suit into the game. More specifically, the ones from the original Spider-Man movie trilogy.
Yeah.
And like that set off such a fire that, you know, I was like, come on, they made like a hell of a game. And like, do you guys not realize that doing something like adding a suit and all these details can break the game? Like, everything needs time.
No, they don't realize that.
You need licensing. Yeah. It's just, my God.
I saw a tweet from the guy that actually made the suit, and it's like, all that webbing is actual geometry on the suit. So it takes a while just to make that. And they're basically summoning a few, why is it here now? Now. And then they added it in. It's like, yeah, because it takes a fucking long time to make this shit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's get to our trends, and then we'll talk about next gen, and then we'll wrap it up, because we're going long.
Yeah.
Stuff that needs to die, and I'm going to say microtransactions and loot boxes, which...
in a fire.
From what I'm seeing, are actually starting to become...
Persona non grata.
They actually become illegal in a lot of places, so they might just go away anyway. But, loot boxes and microtransactions, specifically the kind of shit that Activision is pulling in Black Ops 4, where they'll sell you a skin pack, which will let you unlock two skins, except one of them you can have access to right away.
Thing about Black Ops 4 that makes it even worse is that a lot of that stuff was actually... Like, if you bought it, like, for the first week or so, a lot of that stuff you could get a hold of very easily. And then they automatically, like, it was almost time-locked. After the first couple weeks, they then locked away a bunch of that stuff in loot boxes again.
And then sold it back to you.
Yeah. Specifically, because I think they specifically did that to fool the reviewers. Yep. Which is gross, but...
Which is another practice that needs to die.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to, you know, just to finish off that thought. They let you have access to one skin and then make you grind for 5 hours to get the other one, or charge you another microtransactions of $5 to unlock the stuff that you already paid for.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Activision. Seriously. So that was my biggest pet peeve of the year. So you guys have anything you want to add?
Pretty much
just going back to what Brandon was talking about, you know, like, you know, to try to sell off the reviewers. I've always been about empowering reviewers to just go ahead and, you know what, give shitty scores to the games that aren't finished. You know, who cares?
Yeah, we should. Totally do that. Yeah. So stuff that we did like, I guess we'll go into. This one is actually pretty easy, and that's just the amount of variety of stuff that we're seeing coming out now. The AAA publishers aren't providing the kind of stuff that maybe we want to play, for the most part. I mean, our top three kind of belie that, but what we are seeing is independent, and I guess I can call them AA publishers now, because that's really what they are, giving us games that we wouldn't have ever gotten before.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like Battletech, there's the indie stuff like Celeste, we're seeing stuff like some really weird sandbox stuff like BeamMG. You know, there's a lot of really good things that we're now getting to play. Because, you know, the gatekeepers have kind of fallen down, basically.
Yeah, and what's really working out is, you know, not only are these indies pretty much making AA games that the industry really needs, but it's the fact that, you know, somehow we're also discovering them. Like, honestly, like, I didn't think a game like Celeste or even Dead Cells would just, you know, become as big as they were. And they were mainly because of word of mouth and what, you know, sites have published. So, good on them.
Yep. Anybody else want to chime in here, or should we move on?
Pretty much good.
All right, so let's get to next gen, because believe it or not, it actually isn't too early to talk about that now.
Oh, because we've now got our first next gen console, or at least announced one.
Coming from the absolute left field, yeah. You guys remember Slightly Mad Studios?
Yeah.
You know, Project Cars?
Yeah.
Yep, Need for Speed Shift.
Yeah. Yeah, Need for Speed Shift, Shift 2 Unleashed. They make racing games, apparently. Now it seems like they're going to get in on the next-gen console battle for probably 2020. They announced the Madbox. They've shown some, well, concept renders, I guess, of the machine itself. And yeah, it's mad looking. It's a...
It's a rabbit.
I don't know.
It's a rabbit.
It really is. Yep. It's a rabbit. If you want a console that looks like a rabbit, well, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is happening. Especially because their CEO has been arguing with people about VR. They're saying they're going to do full VR. Mm. He was arguing that current VR is only 60 FPS, which it's not. It's 90. Mm-hmm. He was arguing with Chet Felicik, who you might know as the VR ambassador of Valve, about this, saying, no, if you're doing 90 per hour, it's 180 FPS. And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And got into an argument with him and is like, yeah, these guys are in over their heads. if they're trying to say the guy that ran VR at Valve didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on here, because on the one hand, apart from the weirdness with VR, there's not a whole lot here that doesn't seem like it's overly unplausible.
Yeah.
You know, they could get into the next gen console war. It's like it wouldn't be unheard of for a company on the outside to get in.
Yeah, but where the hell are they getting the money from?
Apparently they have investors.
It's not like they have hugely successful games. It's not like they're Starbreeze, who had payday money.
They couldn't really crowdfund something like this.
Oh.
Although they might try. Mm. You know, this is something that they would have to get outside investors, and they would have to get outside investors that would believe that they could actually make a dent in the market, because you've got established players, Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo, who have a really big head start.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's not just you got to also get developers.
Even in the PC space, you have, you know, Alienware and these other like PC box makers that you know are successful at what they're doing, and they're just repurposing you know current PC tech. Yep. They're not trying to create
unless
their
that's
own.
What this is.
Yeah.
Unless that's what this is. And they're, you know, they're hyping it up as a gaming console, but what they're actually doing is getting into the PC OEM business.
Yeah,
that would make a lot of sense.
I mean, these look like PC tower boxes.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So as far as that goes, we don't know if it's going to happen. We'll keep following this one because I think it's going to be very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ian Bell is, he's a character. There's a reason that it's called Slightly Mad Studios, because they're fucking insane. So, yeah. What else we got to talk about as far as next gen goes? Well, Xbox and PlayStation rumors have been circulating around. I'm sure you guys have been seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Project Scarlet and Microsoft apparently going to release, not one, not two, but four. Consoles.
Oh, that'll be very straightforward.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. What's a little bit unclear is the timetable. I'm thinking that these four consoles are kind of like the initial release and then the S releases at the same time, which would make more sense. But yeah, so there's that. PS5 rumors. There's a lot of people saying that, yeah, this is going to be a pretty big upgrade for over the PS4. But it would still hopefully have backwards compatibility.
Oh,
it had better have backwards compatibility.
They will get crucified if it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. The one thing that's, still unclear is whether we're going to see a potential Switch Pro this year. I say, in all honesty, probably. And I'll tell you, and it'll be an upgrade that Nintendo could make through very little cost, and I'll tell you how. If you guys are familiar with the Switch, it's running the Tegra X1 system on a chip. You know, it's pretty capable. It runs quite well for most part, but yeah. What you may not be aware of is that when that system is running at half of its normal clock speed. And this is done because the cooling on the Switch is such that that's about as much as they can dissipate.
Yeah.
So a Switch Pro, with a higher clock speed, getting it running at full speed with, a better cooler, and it would probably end up being a little bit thicker. But that would probably be a pretty substantial upgrade for very little cost to Nintendo themselves.
They should release that upgrade for the regular Switch. And ask you to get a mini fridge to put it in.
Put it in the
fridge. Yes.
Yeah.
There's the HDMI cord goes out the back, plug it into your TV, and you're good.
Well, they just sell a new dock, with a refrigerated dock.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
And also go and store your drinks.
Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know what to make of that one. That one seems the most plausible to me because there's very little work that they would have to do. Whether they actually go for a full-on Switch upgrade. I mean, come on, guys. The Switch came out in 2016. It's not that old yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not using high cutting-edge tech either.
No, it's not using cutting-edge
tech. Even if it's just you up the clock speed and just have better cooling tech, like that stuff probably is cheaper now than it was 2 years ago.
Yep.
And make it easier to accomplish now for the same price.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you follow timetables, you know, 2019 would be 3 years, so that would be about...
No, Switch was only 2017.
2017?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's not that old.
Well, it's not that old, so...
Nope.
But how long did they wait for the 3DS to do another rev of that, you know? It's like Nintendo keeps doing that all the time. So anybody want to comment on next gen before we wrap up the show? Because I think we're petering out.
I just don't think there's going to be any real momentum for next gen until holiday 2020.
Yeah.
As far as release goes, yeah, I don't think we see them until then.
Yeah, I don't think we get anything announced until next spring.
I mean, with Sony having their media blackout, obviously they're not going to be launching anything in 2019. Microsoft is probably better positioned to do it, but I don't think it would be that well advised either. But
no, I mean they just launched the X last year. I think that system has some time to breathe. It's really I think Nintendo at this point the one that really needs to do the upgrade because
they
really need to.
They're still selling all of the things.
Yeah, they're selling all of them that they can make. And from what I can tell, the people who are buying Switches aren't really particularly concerned about the most state-of-the-art 4K gaming. So, yeah, they're just concerned about...
Well, Nintendo's never going to have that audience anyway.
Yeah, they could if they wanted to. They just don't seem to be in that mindset anymore.
Mm.
So that's our next-gen discussion, and I think we're going to wrap it up for the week. We'll save the rest of these stories for next week, unless something else comes
up.
Well, while we were out.
Yeah.
So... How do I end the show again? So if you haven't subscribed to the show, you can do so on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast aggregator. You can also check us out at smashpad.com, where we've got a lot of articles that you could read right now. What else do we have? Facebook.com/smashpad. If you're still on Facebook and haven't deleted your account yet, you can find us there.
Trust us, there's a million reasons why you probably should. But yes. Much like World of Warcraft, none of us are here by choice anymore.
Yep. So for Patrick Mifflin, Brandon Perkins, Chris Sologi, and Dan Reb Victoria, I'm Filippo Rinolfo, and we'll see you next week.